This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
We consider the value to global society of things bovine now, with the first of a two-part series in which Frederick Dove contemplates the world without. This week, the world without cows.
In this world of ours, things are intertwined. So many single entities, whether natural or man-made, have a massive impact, a huge knock-on effect. Whether it's a tiny insect or a seemingly mundane human invention, take it out of the loop and things can begin to unravel. In this BBC series, I'll be looking at two such linchpins. One is a metal which crisscrosses our planet in millions of kilometres of wire. That's copper. But we begin today with something furry. It has a large, friendly face, large dark eyes, a very wet nose, and it's been man's other best friend for as long as we can remember. It's the cow.
Yeah! Keep 'em going! 15 cents a pound all the way to Kansas City.
This is the most incredible story that teaches how looking at animals can really impact on medical research.
What you would have if, for example, cows were to all disappear. People wouldn't stop eating meat. They've just shifted to lower quality meat.
A Uruguayan diet without beef is almost as unimaginable as, say, a Japanese or Chinese diet without rice.
When the cow herd returns to the village and it's evening, sun is setting and the sky is totally red, dust is raised by the feet of the cow.
If people could reconnect with the cow in some way, they would appreciate what the cow is doing still for us.
Give it up, yeah.
There are something like nearly 1.5 billion cows, oxen, bulls, heifers and steers in our world. They share our planet. But not just that. We farm them. We drink their milk. We wear their hides. We paint them. We write about them. We play games with them. We worship them. But just imagine this. What would our world today be like if they had never existed?
In no animal is there to be met with a greater variety of kinds, and in none a more humble and pliant disposition. The cow is a source of inexhaustible wealth, the pride and the boast of this happy country.
Thomas Bewick there in his General History of Quadrupeds, writing in praise of the cow some 200 years ago. Another author who's done so more recently is Hannah Felton. Her cultural history, simply entitled Cow, starts with the domestication of the aurochs, the cow's ancestor.
The aurochs was a very aggressive, wild, swift-footed animal.
So they were much larger than the cow as we know it today?
Oh, yes, much, much larger. They were 2 metres at the shoulder.
But how on earth, then, would that frightening beast have been turned into the domesticated cow?
There's lots of reasons put forward for domestication. One of the reasons could be that these aurochs became sort of crop robbers and they were coming in and stealing crops from the population. So they would have been herded together, maybe kept in corrals and sort of almost ignored, and their physiology would have changed and their temperaments would have changed, and that could have been a way that you would have got the domesticated cow.
Instead of the aurochs being domesticated, could early man not have turned to another animal, perhaps?
The horse would probably be the most likely replacement to the cow, but the horse wasn't domesticated for at least 2,000, 3,000 years after the cow. If you'd had to rely on the horse, they would have had, you know, maybe 2,000, 3,000 years slowed civilization progress. The more cattle you had, obviously the richer you were. That sort of started the first stratification of society, where you had richer people would put money into building monuments and buildings, which would progress cities, really, and progress urbanisation.
By the 19th century, American cattle ranches were big business, promising huge profits. But even though the boom didn't last, the image of the free-roaming, free-thinking cowboy and his herd remains deeply branded into North America's sense of its own identity. In South America, too, the cow flourished. Areas such as Argentina's Pampas provided ideal conditions. In tiny Uruguay, sandwiched between Argentina and Brazil, beef and its consumption became almost a religion.
Uruguayans have been, it's a comparatively new country. It's only 150, 180 years of independent life. It had no gold. It had no diamonds. So the wealth that it found was in the cattle.
Today, every weekend at Mercado del Puerto in Montevideo, a huge 19th century wrought iron building, Uruguayan families come for one purpose and one purpose only. Rows and rows of stalls selling roasted meat. Raúl Curio is a Uruguayan architect and a lifelong bovivore.
I think you could say that the parrilladas, which are restaurants that are basically for meat eating, are the temples of Uruguayan cookery. And I suppose that the altar is the place where the meat is being cooked. The priests, of course, are the chefs and the cooks that officiate. And the host is the meat itself. There is a very theatrical element to a parrillada because, of course, you have the meat which is sitting at an angle of 45 degrees on a grid, and you have the fire behind. So when you come in, not only the smell assaults your nostrils, but also your eyes are full with this fantastic image. My first memories of eating meat were when I was a small baby. It was considered to be very healthy to be fed on meat juice. So there was a funny contraption made of steel that would take a steak and squeeze the juice out of the steak, and it would be fed to babies.
The cow is the mother to millions of Indian mankind. Mother cow is in many ways better than the mother who gave us birth. She expects nothing from us but grass and grain and gives us service which does not end with her death. We can make use of every part of her body, her flesh, her bones, her intestines, her horns, and her skin.
And that was Mahatma Gandhi writing in praise of the cow. I'm right now actually standing in the great British countryside. It's a beautiful, sunny autumn day. I've come to Bhaktivedanta Manor, just north of London. It's a working farm, but it's run along Hindu principles. Now, with me here are Radha Mohandas, who's the communications secretary down here on the farm, and Sharma Sundra, who's the farm manager. Now, let me ask you first of all, because there's building noise going on in the back, and that's all to do with an even bigger cow sanctuary that you're building here. Now, explain a cow sanctuary, because that's unusual in the British countryside.
Well, sanctuary means in the sense that we have a farming system that has no culling. When an animal is born here, then it will spend its remaining days here. We'll never send it away or sell it. It will die here naturally. But it is a working farm, so the cows are expected to produce milk and the bulls are expected to give their labor. If they're not doing either of those things, then they're giving their dung and their urine to help fertilize the field. So it's a working farm, but they're protected. We'll give them sanctuary.
Radha Mohan, just let's focus briefly on this really important link between the cow and the Hindu faith. How far back does that actually go?
It goes far back as Hinduism itself. And what we see in the Vedic scriptures are numerous references to the cow as being not only sacred, but the symbol of Mother Earth herself. That's called Mother Bhumi, or the goddess of the earth.
Ah, the cow's getting a banana. Are cows big on bananas?
Cows are big on more or less anything that's edible. They'll more or less eat it, obviously, but in vegetarian foods.
I just thought the banana went down the cow's skin and all. I've never seen that happen before.
Skin and all, no hesitation.
The word capital is actually related to the word cattle. I mean, obviously you see the cow very much in spiritual terms as well, but do you also see a money link?
We're not against capitalism, but we'd like to bring it to its original meaning of the word, cowism. In other words, in today's capitalist society, we appear to have lost our way, and therefore we can relate to the recent credit crunch and the fact that a lot of money doesn't actually exist. What is the real wealth? The real wealth is your land. That is real wealth that actually exists. Everything else is ultimately an IOU or pieces of paper. But with your land, with your cow, it's something that is sustainable, it is something which is there, and it is something which is real, and that is what will actually feed you.
As farm manager, you know, you are, in practical terms, a cow protector. I mean, the idea of, I believe it was Krishna who was described as a cow protector, is that right? So how do you feel about that job?
I feel that working with cows is fantastic. There is such a symmetry between cows and man. When you plow a field with bulls, is it a coincidence that they walk the same pace that we do? It's just, every day it's a confirmation that cows and man have a natural relationship. When you work with them, because they have to, they thrive off a disciplined life. That means you have to lead a disciplined life. When you lead a disciplined life, you become happier just by that principle, leading a regulated, disciplined life. So the whole relationship with cows and man means man becomes happier, irrespective of the other kind of fruits that cows bring.
But away from Bhaktivedanta Manor, among Hindus in India, is the role of the cow today still as central as it used to be? And can a journalist like Vijay Rana, for example, even imagine an India without cows?
I think not at all, because cow is very pivotal to entire Indian civilization. If you see the society today, it's modern agriculture, the tractors are coming in, you don't need bulls anymore to farm your fields. The importance of cow has declined economically and socially, but as far as spirituality is concerned, cow is still very important. I'll give you one very interesting example. A few months back, I had my daughter's wedding, and we went through this wedding ritual, and I was quite intrigued to find out that one place the pandit said, now you should donate a cow. Now, there was no cow there. So what say, okay, you donate 2,000 rupees in the name of cow. So that 2,000 rupees went to the pandit, and pandit got a very good excuse because there was no cow, so he got 2,000 rupees extra.
Money was still measured in the form of a cow.
Exactly, exactly. So that sort of symbolism still survives in almost every aspect of life.
During the Raj, the British and the Hindus of India would have had very different relationship with the cow. Did that ever cause problems?
Yes, as far as I can remember, it happened in 1857. The British introduced a new kind of bullet for the Indian soldiers. And it has to be cut from the mouth before loading into the special rifle.
You have to bite the top of it.
You have to bite the top of it and then empty the gunpowder into the barrel of the gun. Now, somehow the rumors spread that this bullet is made of or is mixed with the fat of cow and pig. Now, cow was holy to Hindus and pig was unholy to Muslims. And Hindus and Muslims, both soldiers, were very unhappy while biting the top of this bullet. And these soldiers were so angry that they came back and started this great revolt of 1857. So yes, cow was the spark point of 1857 revolt.
O mother mine, I did not eat the butter. Come dawn with the herds, you send me to the jungle. The words of a famous Indian song in which Lord Krishna denies stealing the butter, made, of course, from the milk of the mother cow. This is the BBC World Service. You're listening to The World Without, and today we're ruminating on the enormous impact that the cow has had on human society and what our world might be like without it. Modern history might have run a less bloody course in Central Africa if differing traditions of cow ownership had not been such a major factor in the ethnic divide between Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda and Burundi. In southern Europe, there'd be no caped matadors fighting snorting bulls. And in Spain, young men couldn't get an adrenaline rush every July running ahead of the bulls as the animals make their way from corral to bullring, running free through the streets of Pamplona. That is just one of many rituals and traditions based on our relationship with the cow. And author Hannah Felton thinks it's all part of a deep emotional link.
Well, probably the best example of this close bond with cattle is in East Africa. The cattle have a really strong association with the family. So they believe that they can contact their past ancestors through the cattle lines. So you have a lineage of cattle as you have a lineage of the family.
Can you imagine a world without cows? Is it possible that we might face a future without cows?
Well, it could be a possibility. Today, we rely on the genes of so few to produce the next generation of cattle. If there was diseases that hit or environment changes, we could possibly wipe out certain sections of cattle population. And who knows? I'm hoping not, but it may be a possibility, a world without cows.
This is the main entrance to the St George's Teaching Hospital in South London. Now, you're asking, why have I brought you to a hospital in a programme about cows? You're about to find out the answer, of course, but let's just say that the link between this hospital and the cow is of direct interest to me, very likely to you, to most of your family, and to millions and millions and millions of human beings, not just now, but pretty much over the past 200 years. Well, I've come to the library of the medical school here at St. George's, and I'm looking at something on the wall in front of me, behind a glass front, that frankly I have never seen in any library anywhere I've been in the world, because what I'm looking at is, let's just say it's poor Blossom. Blossom was once, I would presume, a happy cow, well over 200 years ago. Her hide survives, and as I say, it's hanging now in a library. Well, with me here is Professor Robin Shattuck, an expert in cellular and molecular infection here at St. George's. Robin, simply, why is Blossom in the library?
Well, this is the most incredible story. It goes right back to 1796 with Edward Jenner, who trained at St. George's. And he was living in a time when smallpox was a huge killer. And one day he was consulted as a GP by a milkmaid who had a rash on her hand, and he identified it as cowpox, having come from this cow that we see the hide of on the wall, Blossom. And he saw this as a unique opportunity to test whether the virus that causes cowpox could actually prevent smallpox. So he took the pox from Sarah's hand, the milkmaid, and actually put it under the skin of his gardener's son and did the first vaccination ever done, and later proved that it made this child immune so that he didn't contract smallpox.
The word you just used there was vaccination. And what came as quite a surprise to me was to learn that the word vaccination comes from the Latin word for cow.
You're absolutely correct, vacca. And without the cow, we might have eventually discovered vaccines, but they would have been called something completely different.
And just to bring that up to date, you, I gather, are working particularly in HIV vaccine research. Are you still owing a debt to the cow? Do you still use Blossom's descendants in your research?
Interestingly enough, we still have to culture human cells in the laboratory. And the best way to culture them and keep them happy is to feed them with serum from cows. So cows are still being used to help our research. Now, unfortunately for HIV, we don't have a virus that is safe enough and close enough to HIV to do the similar experiment that Jenner did. But we are using the same approach to engineer vaccines against HIV that we will hope will be successful.
And those cows pass a lot of gas, which may sound funny, but the methane they release is 23 times more harmful than carbon dioxide.
Cow flashing, farty cows are more dangerous to the environment than car emissions. Look, it's true. Look.
The basic problem is, you know, we have turned the modern dairy and beef cow into a fossil fuel guzzler.
This is a true story. We're going to have to put filters on cows' asses.
Ironically, having helped protect so many of us from nasty diseases, the cow now stands accused of being a major factor in global warming because of, well, how can I put it? Basically, because of what comes out of it at both ends.
Cows are ruminants, and in their many stomachs, digestion processes that happen result in the production of methane. And methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. So cows, and particularly the methane they emit, has a lot to do with global warming.
Food and development analyst Raj Patel is based in San Francisco. He's the author of a book called Stuffed and Starved.
In traditional agricultural systems in Asia, for instance, cows will, you know, produce pollution. That pollution actually is part of a cycle of nutrients within an ecosystem. If you like, those cows in that farming system are offsetting themselves. Whereas the cows that are being used in industrial agriculture are sort of plucked out of the cycles of nutrient recycling, of carbon cycling. And so you have a lot of carbon that's not recycled back into an ecosystem. You have a lot of nitrogen that is allowed to run off and cause all kinds of environmental damage there.
In a world without cows, would there be no McDonald's?
in a world without beef, I think McDonald's would still be around. And I think that actually that's a great way of getting to the issue here, that just by removing beef from our diets or from our planet, we're not really getting to the root causes of, you know, the ways in which our demand for protein is harming the planet. If, for example, cows were to all disappear, people wouldn't stop eating meat. We see that even here in the United States, when the price of beef has gone way up and put it beyond, you know, many more people's pocketbooks. People haven't stopped eating meat. They've just shifted to lower quality meat. And in fact, as a result of the financial crisis here, for instance, you're seeing a huge spike in the consumption of Spam. So what that points to is the fact that even if we were to get rid of cows, the habits that we're learning through the industrial food system are indelibly with us.
So if our ancestors had not domesticated the aurochs and sort of turned it into the cow eventually as we know it today, some other animal would have taken its place because of our desire for meat, you're saying?
There was nothing inevitable about, you know, the industrial meat production being the way that we now use cows. It's an accident of history, but precisely because it's an accident of history, it's something that can change. You know, in the future, if we're to have a sustainable agricultural production system, we won't be able to carry on producing meat in the sort of industrial way that we do at the moment.
We took a wrong turn.
I think we have, but it's possible for us to navigate back.
So what is the future for our cattle? Will they all be reared on grain and beer and be routinely massaged with sake, like the Japanese Wagyu cattle who produce Kobe beef? Definitely not. But we have a responsibility to our cattle. We brought them into being, killing off their wild ancestors in the process, and they have played a huge role in shaping our modern world.
The last words of Hannah Felton's book, Cow. So, what would our world have been like if early man had not domesticated the fearsome aurochs? The simple answer is that our friend the cow wouldn't have fed, clothed, warmed, healed, transported, inspired, and, let's put it this way, civilized us. A debt some societies still recognise and others, perhaps, would do well to remember. Next week on the BBC World Service, I'll be looking at the world without copper. And if you think that's just a metal you find in electric wires, then think again. Because without copper, we complex humans might still be simple amoeba, swimming around the primordial soup. In fact, as you can find out next week, copper is so fascinating you could talk about it until the cows come home.
The World Without was presented by Frederick Dove. It was produced by Kate Taylor and was a Whistledown production for BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.